I'm a deputy prosecuting attorney for the county of Maui, state of Hawaii. The state of Hawaii brings this writ of certiorari in front of you today, and we argue that the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in concluding that there was insufficient evidence to support a prima facie case so that a reasonable mind might fail to conclude guilt beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant, Robertson, had constructive control of the drugs, drug paraphernalia, and firearms in this case. Your Honor, there was a trial in this case. A jury of 12 people from the community heard testimony, was able to judge the credibility of the witnesses, to weigh the evidence, and to draw reasonable inferences from the evidence that was presented to them, and came up with a decision finding Ms. Robertson guilty of several counts in the complaint. Your Honor, the state honors, the state submits to you that in this case there was sufficient evidence to show that Ms. Robertson did have constructive possession, did have control, and could exercise that control over the drug paraphernalia, the drugs, and the firearm. There was ample evidence. We take a look at the totality of the circumstances here. In our application for writ of certiorari, we did enumerate several factors, several things in the evidence that show that there was sufficient evidence that in light most favorable to the prosecution that Ms. Robertson had constructive possession of these items. Just touching a little bit on those factors. In this case, in the trial, the jury heard that there was a video surveillance camera within the garage area in a room that was in the back of the garage area that was surveilling, doing surveillance of the outside of the garage. They learned that from the vice officer that did testify for the state that was something that was seen fairly commonly in drug distribution where drugs were distributed.
Mr. Paredes.
Yes.
I wanted to focus in on the firearm issue. Was there any evidence that the defendant was in possession of this firearm? Well, let me go back. There are two arguments the defense makes. One is that it wasn't her liability to a possession of firearm, and minimum term of imprisonment was not pled properly. Mm-hmm. And second, that on the general verdict, there was only a general verdict form, so we're not sure whether she was found to be an accomplice or a principal to possession of the firearm. As far as the first issue is concerned, was there sufficient notice to the defendant that she would be subject to liability under 706663?
In the complaint, Ms. Robertson was charged with as a principal and accomplice for possession of that firearm. That was in the same complaint that she was charged with the methamphetamine charge, which I believe was count one in the complaint.
Those firearm charge was count five.
Count five, and count one was the methamphetamine charge. In the complaint, enumerated that the possession of the meth and the possession of the firearm were on the same day, in the same jurisdiction. And when the facts came out in the trial, the facts were clear that this happened at the same time. The possession of the methamphetamine, the possession of the firearm. The state does believe that the defendant Robertson did have sufficient notice. Because of that, because of the police reports that she did receive even before the trial, she was on sufficient notice of the liability under that section of the mandatory minimum.
There wasn't any connecting language, though, in the complaint itself.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And in prior cases, at least there was some connecting language to put the defendant on notice that they were subject to 706663.
I agree. Yes.
So in that manner, wasn't the complaint deficient?
Your Honor, the position that the state is taking that it was, although there was no specific language within the complaint, it was clear that she would be subject to that type of sentencing because it was the same type of incident.
This subjects her to what, a 10-year prison term?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So, and no possibility of parole?
Parole.
So that is probably the most severe kind of sentence, right?
In this type of case, yes, Your Honor.
So when someone is subject to that kind of liability, that is no possibility even of parole or obviously probation, shouldn't the complaint support that kind of notice that would put a person, I'm sorry, that would inform a person that they were subject to this greater liability?
Your Honor, I believe the case law does support that there should be some notice. In this case, like the state has been saying, it was charged with several counts of different types of possession of drug paraphernalia, firearms. The defendant was on notice because it was the same day, the same jurisdiction, the same set of facts coming out of this.
What about the accomplice principle issue? That is that under 660, 663, the state would have to prove that the defendant possessed, used, or threatened to use this firearm. And we have, or this court has held in Fukusaku, that a person who's an accomplice cannot be guilty under 706-663. So if the jury never made a finding as to whether or not, although she was charged as accomplice or principal, that she was in fact a principal, then isn't she entitled to a new trial?
You know,
at least on that issue.
Right, and I know I did brief a little bit that that issue in my answering brief in regards to that. When we take a look at the facts in this case, really, the facts show that the only reasonable conclusion that the jury could reach was that she was in regards to the possession of the firearm, the principal. She was in constructive possession of that firearm, and the facts clearly show that. Judging by the facts that it was in plain view on the couch. Clothing that
The police officer indicated in his testimony, the first police officer in,
yes,
said that she never looked at the weapon, he never saw the weapon, although he passed by the weapon. The whole place was a mess. He didn't see her move towards the weapon, he didn't see her cast any furtive glance at the weapon. So could a jury also believe that she wasn't in possession of the weapon?
You know, with his testimony, he does state that. He also states that when he was coming in, he had a directive that he was going towards the door of the house. Now, when she comes and testifies, she says that she moves. She sees the gun in the outside of the garage. She moves forward.
Well, to make clear, she saw guns held by the police and they were outside of the garage.
That is correct, right? Your Honor.
So she feared for her children.
Feared for her children.
So she moved, I guess, in the direction of where her children were, which would be past maybe the chair and the couch.
I believe, yeah, she moves forward towards the couch. My understanding of the situation of the house, I believe the door of the house actually is away from where she moves from. So she actually moves towards the couch. The state argues that the jury could reasonably infer from that she's moving towards the couch where they've heard testimony that a firearm in plain view was there. She was moving towards the couch, towards the gun, especially because of her statement that she says she wants to protect her children who are sleeping within the house.
So you infer from that, meaning she wanted to get the gun to protect them?
That could be a reasonable inference, I believe, that the jury could get from the evidence that was put out.
But they could also from the other evidence. Well, first of all, she shouted for the
Right.
Her boyfriend, right?
Right.
But the jury could also, or might also infer that she wasn't going towards the gun, she was just trying to get to her children.
That could be also an inference as well.
But we don't know because the question was never presented to the jury.
Mm-hmm.
So the jury could have found, if we were given a choice, that she would have was an accomplice and not a principal, as far as the gun charge is concerned.
They could have found her as an accomplice. The state of the facts in the trial, though, the state would argue that it was clear that she was in constructive possession of that firearm based on the facts enumerated in our writ of certiorari. And in regards to that, Your Honors, the state just wants to just enumerate things that were in the testimony that does show that there was sufficient evidence in the light most favorable to the state that shows that there was ample evidence that Ms. Robertson had power and the intent to exercise dominion and control over the drugs paraphernalia and the firearms. Besides the video surveillance, the fact that there was a blue bag that had her Mica e-cards, a temporary one and a permanent one within there with marijuana inside, right next to a black purse, and that black purse carrying within it, I believe a methamphetamine pipe with residue inside of it, a scale used to scale methamphetamine, to weigh methamphetamine, Ziploc packets with money logos on top of it, and above that, on the picnic table, just right in front of the couch, there was also a brown ladies' cigarette pack. Now, I stress the term ladies because here the search warrant was for Mr. Gray, who was the defendant Robertson's boyfriend at the time. These things, it was a ladies' cigarette pouch, a ladies' purse, and a blue bag that had Ms. Robertson's identification card. All of these things put together with the fact that Ms. Robertson did testify that she was coming to the house almost daily weeks before to get water because she lived in a place that did not have Huelo, a place where there was no really any running water that they could shower and things like that. The jury could and had ample evidence to take a look and to find that there was sufficient evidence to support the drug, the paraphernalia, and the firearms charges.
Just curious, how large were these Maikai cards?
Maikai cards.
Maikai cards, sorry.
How large were they?
Yeah, because I've seen them. There's some that are really,
really
pretty
small ones.
Yeah.
I believe it was the regular sized, like the credit card sized Maikai cards.
And they were all, were both of them expired?
I'm not sure. I know the temporary one was expired, and I believe the temporary one did have her address, and that address was of that, I believe, Cajope Street address.
Which she didn't live at the time.
Right.
But you, what was her explanation of why those cards were there?
Ms. Robertson's explanation was that she used to live in that residence with her boyfriend, Gray. They did move out because she couldn't get along. Well, Gray couldn't get along with her mother, and they moved out to the place in Huelo because of that. And that apparently it was years before the search had occurred. In the process of moving, she put all of her belongings in different packages just to get out really quickly.
Mr. Perron.
Yes.
Is there any evidence that the defendant was living at the Calpe address prior to this incident?
You know, prior to the incident, she did live in there. I think there was testimony.
What did the witness Villanova testify to?
Villanova, who I believe was a probation officer, did testify that when he did call Robertson in regards to certain matters dealing with the court, she did give him her address as this address.
But you're conceding that she was not living there at the Calpe address, is that right?
You know, she did have, yeah.
You just indicated that to Justice Acoba.
Right.
That yes, they were not living there. So are you conceding that she had not been living there 3 years prior to the incident?
I believe she was not living there. She did have a residence in Huelo. She did have other things. She did have personal belongings at the residence and did use the residence for things to do her businesses, like her tax business. But did not have a, her personal residence was in Huelo. Your Honors, based on all the facts enumerated here, there was ample evidence for the jury to conclude that Ms. Robertson was in power and had the intent to exercise dominion and control over the drugs paraphernalia, and firearms. We'd ask that you overturn the ICA's decision.
Well, the police have been investigating this drug operation, or
yes, yeah, yes, sir.
And they never had any information that the defendant herself was involved. Isn't that true?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your
Honor. So that's why the search warrant was only for her boyfriend and, I guess, what, the premises?
The boyfriend and the premises, yes, for Jeffrey Gray. That was based on the confidential informants and their information that they gave to the officer.
And she was in the garage sorting laundry at 6 o'clock in the morning.
She was in the garage. She was sorting laundry. She was there for over half an hour. The place was lit. It was well lit.
But even the officer said it was a mess, right?
It was a mess.
Stuff all over the place. It was used as a storeroom, right?
Yes.
And so other people had access to it, not only the defendant.
Yes, the other people did have access to the garage. Miss Robertson was in there at the time. She was the only person there within the garage area at the time when the search was executed. Mr. Gray and his daughter did come out.
This was early in the morning. She was trying to get the laundry together because the kids had to go to school, and she was going to drop the laundry off at the laundry, right?
That is what she testified to. Yes.
Yeah. In this bag where the Maikai card was found, there was no other evidence that she was using that bag, was there?
There was just her Maikai cards that they collected, as well as the marijuana that was within the different packages within the blue bag.
And defense counsel brought out there wasn't any purse, any cash, any receipts from any store in that bag.
Yes, Your Honor.
Something you might normally believe would be found with a Maikai card, Maikai card.
Yeah, that is correct, Your Honor. That's correct. So, and I believe what the officer did state was that he didn't remember exactly what was in the blue bag. He just remembers that he did collect the Maikai cards because that was some form of identification, as well as the marijuana.
But if there had been deposit receipts, he indicated he would have noted that.
That is correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice and Associate Justices Joyce Matsumori Hoshijo, on behalf of Deborah Jane Robertson, defendant and respondent in this case. Your Honors, in this case, the summary disposition order issued by the Intermediate Court of Appeals did not contain grave errors of law or fact, nor has the state asserted that this order reflected any obvious inconsistencies with decisions of the Supreme Court, federal courts, or of its own decisions. The ICA's order did show that it evaluated the trial evidence in the strongest light for the prosecution and concluded that substantial evidence did not exist to support the jury's findings of guilt for the drugs, drug paraphernalia, and firearms charges. And in its evaluation, the ICA was required, we would submit, did give full play to the jury's right to assess credibility, to weigh the evidence, and to draw reasonable or justifiable inferences from the evidence presented at trial. And looking at this record, Your Honors, the evidence fails the substantial evidence test. This is clearly a constructive possession case, and in order to support a finding of constructive possession, the evidence must show a sufficient nexus between the accused and the drugs or firearms in this case to permit an inference that the accused had both the power and intent to exercise dominion and control over the drugs and firearms. Mere proximity is not enough, and that's really what we have in this case, Your Honors. Most of the state's facts listed in its application for writ support the concept of mere proximity or mere presence. For example, Deborah was alone in the garage early in the morning sorting her laundry for about half an hour. There were drugs located, just situated on the couch, next to the couch and picnic table area. There was a pistol on the couch loaded and ammunition in a cooler by the couch. Some of the state's facts also support her association with Jeffrey Gray, who it's undisputed was the target of this police investigation several weeks before the November 13th execution of the search warrant. Police had been conducting surveillance of that 36 Cahope Street residence, and during that period of time, they saw at least 19 cars go to and from that residence. They ran license plate checks. Some of these individuals had conviction records, some for firearms charges, and the only person, Jeffrey Gray was one of the persons seen at the residence, but never during that surveillance had they seen Deborah Robertson. So they clearly had no idea that she was involved in any kind of drug enterprise going on, if there was one in fact going on at that residence. So the facts that the state points to in support of its argument for constructive possession, there are two areas that the state focuses on. One is the gun, and then the possession of this blue bag. Now, with regard to the gun on the couch, what the testimony at trial established was that Deborah was in the back area of this garage. And this garage area was not a large garage, but it was packed full of things. She previously and Jeffrey Gray had moved out from the residence. And so when they moved out, as is often the case, they took all their junks, their belongings, and threw everything into the garage. It's also undisputed that a number of other family members were also living in the residence, including Deborah's sister, Patricia Ramos, and her daughter, Christiana, the daughter's boyfriend, and their two children, as well as the mother, Mrs. Marquis. Now, what happened on that morning was, at some point, Deborah was in the back of the garage, and she saw, as she's looking out towards the street, apparently a barrel of a gun pointing towards from the hedge area. And so there's the house, there's the garage area, there's a driveway, and then there's some hedges. And there's a gun pointing in. She has no idea who or what is going on. She doesn't know who that is. She has no idea at that point that it's the police. So she explained in her testimony that her first instinct was to protect my daughter and my grandchildren, which is to the side. Now, the layout of that garage is, as you're looking into the garage, and say it's like a square, you divide it in half. One half on the right-hand side as you're looking in is where Deborah's mother's car had her car parked there. The other half, or in that other half and towards the middle, is the couch, and in front of the couch is the picnic table area. Now, the mom had already left for work, that's clear. So what happened was, and also the door to the house is, as you're looking in, on the right-hand side. So in other words, Deborah's mother comes out from the house, gets into her car, and takes off for work. When Deborah sees the gun barrel, she begins to walk forward, and her first instinct is to protect her children, which is to the side. And to the side would mean to the side door going into the house, I would submit. And Officer Hunt himself testified that when he entered the garage and saw Deborah, she basically stood there. She looked scared. She probably just froze at that point. And, you know, as far as the evidence goes, she was in proximity, he says, a couple of paces to the couch. So there's the couch, which is facing outward, apparently on the, as you're looking at the right-hand side of the couch, he says, is a .45 caliber weapon sitting on top of a cushion. Now, Officer Hunt himself went by, he said, within arm's reach of Deborah before entering into the house, because they had thought Jeffrey Gray was in the house. That's who they were after. So he goes by and passes by the couch with the gun and Deborah. But he testifies he never saw the gun on the couch. And I would submit to this court, he was basically a firearms expert. He testified that in the Marines, he had expertise in using a .45 caliber weapon. So, and he even testified when asked by defense counsel, isn't this a finesse weapon? Isn't this a lot of gun for a lady? And he admitted that these facts were true, that it was a difficult gun to use, and it would require a great deal of force and pressure to unlock the safety and pull the trigger on the gun. But basically, he never saw the gun, and he never saw Deborah make any furtive movement toward the couch or the gun. So we would submit that there's no reasonable inference from these facts that Deborah had the intent and capability to exercise.
Where does Mr. Perez get the information that there was movement towards the couch where the gun is?
Yes, the testimony, and this is from Deborah Robertson's testimony, because Officer Hunt never saw her move at all. All she said was when she saw the gun, she walked forward. And at the point at which she stopped, she was by the couch area. And also on her left, so it would be the door to the house as well.
I got the impression from Mr. Perez's argument that the movement was away from where the children were and towards the couch where the gun was. Is that right?
Well, all that we know for certain is she took steps from the back of the garage area where she was sorting laundry. It appeared to be straightforward. There's no testimony that she walked towards the couch, or in fact that she actually moved towards the door to the house. It's just she came forward.
When I asked you where did Mr. Perez get the information that she moved towards the couch, you said it came from her testimony. Did she testify that she moved towards the couch?
No, she did not, Your Honor. She testified that she moved forward. I'm sorry.
Is she towards the couch?
It is in the direction of where the couch is, but she never
away
said
away from where the children were.
She never said anything to that effect, as far as
and what you testify. I'm testifying. What you argue in terms of the location of where the children were, is it away from the children and towards the couch?
No, the children were in the house sleeping at that point, so she would not be moving
into
away.
The house. Where is the door located to get to the children?
She would be moving toward from the back of the garage. If you picture that, there's the door here and then the couch here. She moved forward, and then she stopped at the point when the police came.
I'm sorry, I'm still confused. Where is the door from her forward movement? Is it away from the door where the children were to get to the children?
It's toward the door.
Towards the
yes, door. Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor, yes.
Did the prosecutor argue that she was going towards the gun to, her intent was to protect her children?
Yes, in closing argument, that was their, they urged the jury to draw that inference from her movement. That's correct. And our position would be that from the mere fact that she stepped from the back of the garage some steps forward, that in and of itself is not enough for the jury to draw a reasonable inference that she was going for the gun. I think there needed to be more evidence. There was nothing like she tried to reach for the gun, or for that matter, that she was reaching for the door. She could have just been moving forward to get a closer look at who it was, what was going on. Or she could have just been trying to figure out what to do. It's just, from that meager evidence, there's just not enough to make that leap that she was then going to go for the gun and somehow try to protect her entire family.
Counsel, from the mere fact that the jury found her guilty, could the inference be drawn that they didn't believe her when they said, when she testified that she was going towards the door?
That's certainly possible, Your Honor. That is the inference, but at the same time, there is no other evidence of any kind of furtive movement, and really what you have here is her movement forward, and she basically winds up at the couch. And we would submit that there just needs to be more to show that if a person generally is going to take steps to go and secure a weapon, that there would be more. And I think what happened was then when she realized the police had announced themselves, when they charged into the house, she stopped. She offered no resistance. She, in fact, cooperated with the police, and then that was the end of that. In contrast, when they apprehended Jeffrey Gray, who was in the back bedroom garage, he came out, was extremely hostile with the officers, was very, very obviously upset and angry. So there is that a very clear distinction in that case.
Is there a dispute that the 45 caliber weapon was not in plain view?
We have no evidence to the contrary. We just have facts from which apparently they have the photograph of the gun being on the couch. So there's no way we can say that that's not what they saw. But it's just, it in some ways just seems rather implausible when you do have officers going in. And I would imagine that even before they conducted this raid, they're going to have their officers kind of assembling and probably looking into the garage area where they're going to be charging into, and to kind of size up, you know, the area. And it would just seem that a gun of that size on a couch would not be something that they would not see if they were going past the gun during the execution of the search warrant. It just didn't seem plausible. And also, when Mrs. Marquis had left for work, she had testified that she did not see anything in the garage, no gun or anything, and she had left shortly before the police execution of the search warrant.
To prove possession, you have to, or a reasonably cautious person would have to be able to determine that there was an intent to exercise dominion and control over the thing possessed. And so from what you stated, what in the evidence indicates there was any intent on the part of the defendant to exercise dominion and control over that weapon?
We would say absolutely nothing in the evidence would support that, Your Honor, because that's part of the problem, is there's probably a number of possibilities when you look at her movement forward that it could be. But I think to get to that next step where you actually find that she was going to get the gun, there needs to be more. And so based on this record, I would say that there's clearly not.
What about the other evidence recovered from the garage? What's your argument on why there wasn't constructive possession?
With regard to the purse, which the state argues that contained the grocery store cards, these Ma'ikai cards, that bag also had marijuana in it. And the Intermediate Court of Appeals did find that that bag was hers, and therefore sustained that conviction on that count. The card in there was apparently identified as a temporary and permanent Ma'ikai card. The temporary card had an address of 124, I believe, Kahope Street. And what Deborah testified to was that was the street address earlier, before all of the numbers on that street had been changed. So that was clearly an old Ma'ikai card. The other Ma'ikai card, if it was a permanent one, had apparently no address or anything on it. It was just, it had her name. And so that was the identifying feature in that card. Deborah herself testified that the bag could have been hers because during the moving out process, she said so many things were thrown into the garage. But even if that is the case, Your Honors, those facts, the same facts that she, the mere fact that she possessed that bag, does not lead to a reasonable inference that she then had the power and intent to exercise control over all the contraband found in the black bag, in the other brown cigarette bag, in the ammo in the cooler, and everything else in that garage that was found. It is undisputed that she was not the target of the police investigation. It was clearly Jeffrey Gray. And she also, it's undisputed, did not have exclusive possession of this garage area. There was ample testimony that with her sister and the daughter and the boyfriend, they had friends come over to the garage area where they would hang out and socialize. There was testimony that the boyfriend's friends were hunters, so they would get together and then go hunting, but they would hang out in the garage area. So a number of other people had access to that area. And so then to say then that the fact that the bag is here and that somehow infects every other thing such that Deborah somehow had dominion and control over that, all of those items, I think is stretching credulity, Your Honors. That's just what we have is that bag in addition to many, many, many other things found in the garage, some of which may have been hers, but many of which were not. So I think that link, there is no reasonable inference you could make from the fact that a bag, which may be current or old, was found, and then therefore everything else that had no identifying marks or anything on it could then be said to be hers.
What was the evidence as to how long the police were outside before they started moving in? How long did they were they surveilling her, the defendant in the garage, before they moved to execute?
I don't recall there being any specific time frame on that, Your Honor. All that I recall was that there basically is like a line of police officers that what happened was they would do like a, I think they called it a four-point securing of the premises where they have the officers fan out to each location, every corner of the house, and then a line of them were then basically plowed through the garage area and then apprehended Deborah and Jeffrey and other people in the house as well. And there was contraband found in the house, but the occupants of the home were not charged with that contraband, and Deborah was not as well. And
do you agree with the estimate of time that the defendant was in the garage before police executed the warrant?
It was approximately. She testified that she got there early in the morning, maybe about, I think she said it was 5:10 or 5:15, and she was in the, first she went in to talk to her mom. Mom was making coffee, and then she had about 12 loads of laundry, which basically she just dumped on the garage floor. And so, you know, it's adding mess to a mess, basically. And what the plan was that morning was Jeffrey Gray's daughter was staying at that Cahope Street residence, and that was her first day of intermediate school. So the plan was to go and have Deborah sort the laundry, take the daughter and take her to school, and then she would complete her laundry tasks that day. And that was what the plan was. Which
she's going to drop the laundry off at a laundromat, right?
Yes.
On the way back. But what about the accomplice issue? What's your position?
Well, Your Honor, this entire prosecution from the get was the focus of the investigation was Jeffrey Gray. It was his name. He was the subject. He was the one seen allegedly dealing drugs at that Cahope Street residence. And so then, of course, the jury is presented with this indictment, which charges Deborah Robertson for the constructive possession of everything in that garage. And so the state is now saying that she is a principal, but it just doesn't seem to jive with the tenor of their investigation to then bring the prosecution forward and to say now basically she's the principal, as if she's the one who is running some kind of drug ring out of the house. Those facts just don't bear themselves out, Your Honor. But the problem is that there was no jury finding of accomplice liability, so it is not clear. I mean, it may very well be that they found her to be the principal in this case because she was the only one found in proximity of those items. But at the same time, the person who they were after was Jeffrey Gray in this case, and they did not get him, basically.
Well, in any case, under Fukusaku, there had to be a jury's finding, specifically when someone's charged both as a principal or accomplice, that the person for 70663 liability would have to be found to be a principal. And the jury would have to make that finding, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor, yes.
And was that the case here?
The indictment went in, the jury was instructed as principal or accomplice, but no jury finding was made on any of those counts.
I'm sorry, again, how much time was she in the garage?
From the, she said she arrived at 5:15, took some time to talk with her mom, so the estimate is roughly about half an hour before the police came.
And did the prosecution argue that she was a principal? Was that a theory of theirs?
The instructions went in as principal or accomplice in this case. Yes, I recall.
Knowledge or presence don't equal possession.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. No, it's even if Deborah Robertson knew that all of those items were there, and even if she knew who owned those items, that fact alone, and I would submit, even if she resided at the Cahope Street address, mere knowledge and possession of a place is not sufficient evidence for the jury to reasonably infer that she had the intent to exercise control and dominion over all those items. I think the law is very clear on that, Your Honor. If there were no further questions, I would respectfully request that this court affirm the ICA's summary disposition. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm just curious about the amount of drugs that were found in a garage, in the bag, in the purse, in the cigarette case. The value was up there.
Yes.
The 8-ball was made of
600, perhaps quite a bit.
Total of, what do you say, $40 to $50 a package,
mm-hmm.
and about what, 30 packets or 35 packets?
That's correct. Evidence was adduced at trial that was clearly a saleable amount of the crystal methamphetamine.
There's a lot of marijuana as well.
The quantity of the marijuana was not as great. The marijuana found in Deborah Robertson's in the blue bag was not, I don't believe, a substantial amount.
And she was the only one that was seen in an open garage during this period of time. You say half an hour, and these things are just laying around there?
Yes.
Was there any theory as to why this? All of these drugs were just left there? I mean, if it wasn't hers, or...
Well, it's the description of the garage was it was just a place that was packed full of all kinds of boxes, clothing, and everything else. So it's not like it was a neatly arranged type of garage. But I would concede that yes, the items were found where they were found. They were photographed on the picnic table, on the couch, but. There were other things in the garage as well, strewn all over the place, and it was Deborah's testimony that she was not aware of those items being there. Yes.
And people would just come and go.
Yes, there was testimony, yes, that the garage area was a place where friends and family hung out. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors, the state would just like to submit that, you know, in this case, we did have the initial focus of the search warrant was Jeffrey Gray. When the police officers went into that garage, they saw something different. They saw They saw Deborah Robertson in the garage. They saw a lady's purse with Deborah Robertson's identification within that purse. They saw a lady's cigarette case with an 8-ball of methamphetamine inside. They saw a black lady's purse. These things were on a picnic table, on the table and on the seat of that table, in an area that they say that numerous people came in and out all the time. Deborah Robertson says that she packed away a lot of her stuff, and it was years ago since she lived in that area. Why was her Maikaʻi card on the seat of the picnic table where people come in and just hang out?
Mr. Paredes, yes. Ms. Robertson testified that she lived in a place with no running water. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Where did they get their water?
You know, she does state that weeks beforehand, she would be coming to her mom's place almost daily to get the water. So she was coming to that area, to that residence daily before this search.
And also, Mr. Gray's daughter was living at that house, right?
Yes, and just I believe it was not more than a week that she had lived there. They had brought her and Mr. Gray had brought the daughter there to live with Deborah Robertson's mom. So they were there at the house, and she did testify that she did go to the house to speak to her mom, when she was so. It's not like she wasn't familiar with the garage area. She, from the testimony that she was there daily for weeks, she was familiar with that area. She had stuff in that garage area. Why was her Maikaʻi card on the picnic table in a bag where people come out and hang out? She had put it there that day.
Well, you don't know that.
You're right. And that is an inference that the jury probably took. They convicted her on those counts, and that's the inference that the jury took. Thank you.
This matter would be taken under advisement.